Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
1-800-Flowers.com is more than your birthday, anniversary, or just because gift-giving destination. We put our hearts into everything we do to help you celebrate all life's special occasions with friends and family. From our farmers and bakers, florists and makers, everything from 1-800-Flowers is made with love every step of the way, because we know that nothing is more important than delivering a smile. To learn more, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening to Creative Control. While I have you here, please consider supporting Youth Empowerment and Support Services, otherwise known as YES. Based in Edmonton, Alberta, YES provides immediate and low-barrier overnight and day shelter, temporary supportive housing, and individualized wraparound supports for young people aged 15 to 24. They work collaboratively within a network of care focused on the prevention of youth homelessness by providing youth with the necessary supports to stabilize their housing, improve their well-being, build life skills, connect with community, and avoid re-entry into homelessness. Learn more about how to donate or otherwise support YES by visiting yess.org.
Hey, this is Adam from Toronto, and I support Creative Control because Vish is full stop one of the best arts interviewers in Canada, or anywhere in the world, really. He approaches every episode like he's known the artist for years, creating a conversational atmosphere that gets straight to the heart of the work. No one else in podcasting gets it quite right like he does, with a mixture of meticulous research, wise artistic insights, and well-humored personal connections. I proudly support Vish and Creative Control on Patreon. You should too.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Daniel Romano is a gifted multi-instrumentalist, songwriter, producer, poet, musician, and filmmaker currently based near his hometown of Welland, Ontario. Though already respected for his prolific and inspired recorded output, Romano and his band The Outfit have been particularly productive since the dawn of the COVID-19 pandemic lockdowns, releasing countless albums since the late winter of 2020. In 2021, he released 3 albums, the solo effort Kissing the Foe, a live album with The Outfit called Fully Plugged In, and the full band studio effort Cobra Poems, all of which were released via the label he co-founded, You've Changed Records. Daniel and I caught up recently for a chat about a whole host of things, including the movie and the band The Doors, the perilous prospect of touring again, recording the Julie Dwaran album I Thought of You, and then playing 3 recent shows in her backing band, why he has ceded some of the lead singing duties in his band to Outfit member Juliana Riolino, the Beatles documentary Get Back, and how so many rock music conventions were invented because of their unprecedented success, how Dan can sometimes freestyle in the studio a little bit like Jay-Z, and the story of the time that I met Jay-Z after co-producing a Jay-Z interview segment on the CBC radio show Q, the time Rick Rubin tried to get Jay-Z to rap over a Fugazi song, Dan's work with his wife Carson McHone on her forthcoming Merge Records release Still Life, why his band is mentioned in the liner notes to Bob Dylan's Springtime in New York bootleg series edition, plans to release some digital releases on vinyl, other future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol with additional support from Blackbird Music, a well-stocked record store with locations in Edmonton and Calgary, Alberta, and friendly staff who will happily help you source special orders for hard-to-find titles, which you can learn more about at blackbird.ca, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is the 660th episode of Creative Control, featuring your friend and mine, Daniel Romano, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Dan. How's it going?
It's going well. How are you?
I'm well. It's nice to see you via the internet.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
What do you got?
I got a BBC News thing that I forgot to turn off my phone.
Let me guess.
I put it on Do Not
It's bad
Omicron,
news, I bet.
Yeah. Omicron 50 to 70% less likely to need hospital care.
Oh, it's good news.
Yeah. Than previous COVID variants, analysis by UK health agencies.
What was the percentage of that?
50 to 70% less likely.
Okay. That's pretty good odds.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That was the BBC News report that came in on Thursday, December 23rd at 10:06 a.m.
That's good.
So,
that's good
depending
stuff.
On when people are hearing this, yeah. The news might have changed.
That
is good.
I thought they were going to not tell people that until after a lot of people got their boosters, because I think that was already news coming out of South Africa. But I felt like, okay, well, they're not going to tell people in a broad spectrum so that more people will go, you know.
Do you feel generally like we know too much?
I don't know anything.
let me put it this way. Do you feel like we've been given too much varied information to actually make sound decisions?
I mean, I feel like that's just, par for the course with, I don't want to make golf analogies. I don't want to make anything about golf. I feel like that's just how it goes when the entire world is dealing with one thing.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to get it from everywhere. Everyone's talking about it. You can't have a conversation without it being part of it. It's just how it is.
Well, I read a funny tweet the other day from someone who said if COVID had happened pre-internet, everyone would be vaccinated.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have so much information that we can't handle the truth. Remember that movie, A Few Good Men, with Jack Nicholson and Tom Cruise?
I do,
and
yeah.
Kevin Pollak and Demi Moore and Kevin Bacon? There's lots of people in it. Yeah. Anyway, and there's someone else notable.
It's like the movie JFK, where everyone's in it.
That's right. That's true. Even
Every
Newman
actor.
From Seinfeld.
That's right.
Newman is in it. And John Candy is in it. You're like, what yeah. the?
Everyone is in it. Everyone's in it.
Donald Sutherland he plays the informant. When's the last time you watched JFK? I watched it like a year and a half ago.
I don't know. I don't even know if I've ever seen it. I just heard somebody say that once.
I was dating someone on 9/11. The woman I was dating, admittedly, would be like, I don't know what's happening. And we were watching it at the University of Guelph, like on the TV.
Yeah.
And I made the very insensitive comment as a gaggle of people were like, what is this? What's happening? Like, we didn't even know it was a terrorist attack.
Yeah.
But then they started to say it, and I said something very wrong, which I tend to do sometimes. I said, like, you know, as far as plans go, that's pretty good. And everyone sort of tittered.
Yeah.
Like not taking into the humanity, but I'm
totally.
Like, as far as destructive, horrible things, Anyway, that night she was there, my lady friend at the time. And then I was like, she's like, I don't know, why do people hate America? What's going on? I don't understand. I'm like, oh, you know what we should watch tonight? JFK.
Totally.
And it blew her mind. She's like, yeah. What? I'm like, you know, whatever. It's Oliver Stone. But actually, you know what, Dan? Last night, you know what I watched? The Doors.
The documentary.
I think it is a documentary. The Oliver Stone film, The Doors, has shown up on one of my streaming services.
Yeah.
So I've been watching. It's so long. What was with Oliver Stone? Everything was like 3 hours. You ever watch an Oliver Stone movie? Have you ever seen any?
Yeah, probably. I don't know.
You don't know. You don't know the director?
You're talking about The Doors, like the band, right?
The band, The Doors.
Yeah.
Had a biopic made. Right. Yep. By Oliver Stone in like 1990, 91 or something like that. I know this because I somehow became obsessed.
Who plays James Morrison?
James Douglas Morrison was played by Val Kilmer.
Oh, that would be good. He's
to
good.
To an almost eerie extent. Like it was to the point where they're like, the rest of the Doors were like, maybe we can play shows with this guy doing it. But instead, I think they got Ian Astbury from The Cult to do some of them.
Right.
And then I found if you get into a Doors wormhole, you'll find Eddie Vedder singing with The Doors. And it's very, it's weird. I was obsessed with The Doors when I was a little kid, to the point where I played, when I was in Connecticut, I bought a double live concert album when we were visiting my mom's brother, my uncle. And, I decided to find it on the streaming service and play it in the kitchen. I knew every word to every like ad lib and poem. My wife was like, why do you, she just had no idea. You hide your Doors fandom a little bit, I think, as a person, don't you? Did you ever?
Here's the thing. If I was Oliver Stone and I was making a biopic of the Doors, I would sort of venture more into the world of realm of fantasy and add a bass player.
They had a bass player in LA. First of all, why was that your go-to thought? You think the Doors were really lacking in the bass department? They didn't. So for those who don't know the Doors, they're the keyboardist, Raymond Daniel Manzarek, I want to say. I feel like that was his name. He passed on, but he was the keyboard player, and they never had a bass player. The bass parts would be handled by Raymond Daniel Manzarek. And this was quite the novelty at the time. So as a musician yourself, you feel a lacking in Doors material. You think they needed a bassist?
I've never fallen into the grips of James Morrison, personally. But also, just as far as the spectrum of music goes, I feel like they could have benefited from somebody holding it down.
What was it about? Because you're a music fan and a consumer, you like music. I think you study music a little bit. What was it that your internal taste making radar told you? Doors? No, don't even go into that. What was it about? What is it about the Doors that you were like, no?
I don't know, but I think that it's genuine because it was like I was young, so I didn't know, you know. Like my parents were in a rhythm and blues band and they would rehearse at home and I would hear all of it. And so like, you know, when I was 13, I started playing drums for them, filling in for Tony Bosco, who was the drummer who would have things going on or whatever, couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And I knew all these songs, but I didn't know who they were by or anything, you know. And I just, whenever they would do a Doors song, I didn't like it.
You just, I don't know. Instinctively, you were like, no.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. I don't know what it was.
No, they're not.
But to be fair, that doesn't always, I can't stay true to that statement for everything because they would do Van Morrison songs and I was like, oh, this is fine. And now I don't like that.
Right. Is it because of his various supposed political stances, which I think are...
I try to keep those things separate, but I don't know. It's just like too much like meandering. Just like pick a melody.
Is it at all colored by the fact that in the film by Martin Scorsese, The Last Waltz, Van Morrison appears in a unitard and gesticulates wildly, like he kind of...
Low high kicks.
Yes, low high kicks. That's a very good way of putting it. Yeah, when someone gets into low high kicks, You can tell something's off there. Did you like his? He does Caravan, right? Yeah, in the Last Waltz.
I think that sort of like repetitive scat thing never really gelled with me.
I see. So he's taken a lot of flack over the last year for his latest album, and I've talked about this a little bit extensively when Andre Etier and Sandra Perry were on the show, because he came up
as a group. Two and one.
That was the episode of the show. Yes. Yeah. Well, Sandra cool. has been.
That's probably a good
it
one.
It was Dan. You should check that one out. It's a bit of.
You know what? I will.
if you listen to podcasts and mine at all, that's a good one. I was very happy with that one, but it was a ramble. It was one of those ones where we didn't really even talk about the collaborative record they made. We just went off about our shared youths and Tom Waits and Dylan and. There's this book that I don't know if you heard tell of it. It's by Mark Howard, the engineer on...
Right, yeah.
Did you know this book? It's called...
No.
You should... So what it is Mark Howard wrote a book. I want to say it's... I did this the last time. I wish I had it in front of me, but I think it's called Listen Up. I'll send you a link to it. Because Sandro... Mm-hmm. I told Sandro about it, and he bought it, and he just long texts about what he thought of it. But for those who don't know, Mark Howard was a recording engineer... And he was a protege of Daniel Lanois, beginning somewhere around Oh Mercy.
Yeah.
Like just around 88, 89, he started working with Lanois. And he worked on the Dylan record, Oh Mercy. But he also worked on Time Out of Mind. He also like worked on Day for Night by the Tragically Hip. And
oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and he's worked with Neil Young and on Lanois.
Yeah.
And he and Lanois had a bit of a falling out. But the point is...
That's probably an easy thing to happen.
So Mark Howard, oh yeah, you'll love the stories of Lanois and Dylan, the iceberg between them after Dylan couldn't handle, according to Mark. But the point of the book, the point of this, by the way, is Mark Howard, he's okay now, but he was diagnosed with a terminal illness. And he'd had this really rich and storied career working on so many great records. Like I mentioned all the people, Lucinda Williams, like Tom Waits, like, just a bonkers experiences. But he thought he was dying. So he wrote a book that basically, I mean, it does. It excoriates Lanois.
Yeah.
And says that he took credit for things. Like he says, Lanois didn't even like Time Out of Mind. He was actually, he thought it was blues rock, boring blues rock. And he ostensibly, after a major tantrum, according to Howard, Dylan banned Lanois from most of the sessions for the rest of the time. Anyway, but it could be gossip, and I don't want to. Dan Lanois has been on. I've talked to Dan a bunch. He's been very nice to me and friendly. But I also met Mark in the course of covering this book, and he seemed very kind. So I'm trying to be a diplomat, and sometimes based on his recount, they seem very. It seems very viable and true. I mean, you might remember this after a Time Out of Mind. Dylan made Love and Theft by himself and kind of dismissed Lanois' swampy production. Do you remember? There was a little chill between them. And they won, like, Album of the Year Grammy. Like, it was very successful.
In my opinion, Time Out of Mind is far superior. Or, sorry, I mean Love and Theft is far superior to Time Out of Mind.
Sonically? Or just
in,
all, as
in,
a whole?
In every way.
I see. Yeah. Okay. I've, for 20, 15 years, I said Love and Theft was my favorite Dylan album.
Yeah, me too.
But then I've fallen. I say it wavers between that and Time Out of Mind. I just love that era. These days, I became reacquainted and more fond of Time Out of Mind because I sing and play guitar to my kids at night. Mm-hmm. And Ramona, in particular, I sing Make You Feel My Love. And I also, that doesn't always put her out. So you have to go. Then you have to go longer. So then I'll do Standing in the Doorway.
Mm-hmm.
And. So just, I mean, it's one of those things with me. I don't know what it is. Songs, I retain songs as a fan, and it comes quickly. Like, I don't know what it is. Like that, as you know, Dan, I'm sure, Standing in the Doorway, there's a lot of stuff going on, and I keep going, and I play. It's really fun. Anyway, I agree. I love Love and Theft. I wrote a master's thesis on Love and Theft. I think it's brilliant. But anyway, all this to say, you should get that book. I think it's called Listen Up by Mark Howard. And I wish I had it in front of me. But anyway, what was the point of all this? Why were we talking about Daniel Lanois? And I had something. We were talking about COVID. The Doors. Let me tell you. Let me tell you this though. You know who liked the Doors a little bit is Iggy Pop.
I had a dream about Iggy Pop last night.
Oh, what was happening in it?
Oh, it's very strange. We were escaping something or running around, either chasing or being chased, through the streets of, let's just say, New York. And then we ended up in like the front loader of a tractor, and we had to like hide there and wait for this like, two carriage transport truck to turn a super intense corner. And we had to sort of like at the exact right axis jump over it. And once we passed that threshold, there was this understanding that I was the reincarnate of Iggy Pop, and he explained to me that reincarnation can take place in a non-linear sense where we're both actually still living at the same time.
Oh.
And I'm sort of, he's consuming the energies of my pseudo youth, and I'm consuming his wisdom in this way that is like, moving in all directions. And it was crazy.
That's lovely and beautiful and has a sort of existential philosophical bent. I think it's also at least one subplot of the film Ghostbusters.
Yeah, totally.
So there's a lot going on there. Have you ever encountered Iggy Pop yourself in your travels?
No.
Okay. So I like Iggy Pop, and he was on the show. Once,
oh, yeah?
Which was a big thrill. Yeah. That's one of the biggest things ever. I was like, what the hell? My point, though, about the Doors is that Iggy saw the Doors, and they were so Morrison, James Douglas Morrison, was so intoxicated or inebriated or what have you, that Iggy thought, oh, I could do that. It was so chaotic, and I think the show he saw, it must have been probably in Detroit or something like that. It was so bad, but good. Like, he loved it. I think, and some will debate this, because there's obviously some pretense, just in the poet shaman thing that Morrison was maybe going for, but proto-punk potentially, some proto-punk stuff. I mean, the Doors were really influenced by like Coltrane. If you listen to that band, mm-hmm. My wife and I were watching Kevin Dillon pretend to be John Densmore, the drummer, and she's like, she was rapping present, sort of absentmindedly looking at the screen as I was just like trying to wind down watching the Doors wind down from the day. And she was just listening, and every once in a while I would watch Kevin Dillon emulate the drumming. She's like, that the drumming's good, right? Like, you must like that as a drummer. I'm like, yeah, I always thought John Densmore was a really great drummer. I never really famously Led Zeppelin did shows with the Doors and claimed they just hated them. Hated the Doors, hated them as a, thought they were terrible musicians and all this stuff. But then I
that makes me like the Doors more.
I thought they were actually, again, I'm on a slight Doors buzz.
Yeah.
And because I just decided to watch the movie, and then I listened to that. That is my favorite thing, is it's called like the Doors in Concert. When I had it in 1991, it was a double cassette. I assume it's a double record or something. Anyway, I'll tell you, like, it's, as a performer, he didn't seem like, he's not a good person. I also recently read Please Kill Me. You ever read that book, that oral history of punk by Legs McNeil?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Yeah, so I think it's Danny Fields.
Yeah.
He says Jim Morrison was a fucking asshole, just a horrible guy. And
he seems terrible.
Yeah, he did seem terrible, and I'm trying to,
It's a nightmare to be around.
Yes, and like there was a thing with him and Nico from the Velvet Underground, and they had a thing. But anyway, there's a whole lot of gossip in that book too. But yeah, they didn't seem. That,
they would have made beautiful children.
They would have. Yes, there's a scene. There's a sex scene between them, supposedly, in the Oliver Stone film.
Who plays Nico?
I don't know, but it's someone who does not resemble Nico. Or sound
tough to do.
Sound like Nico. It's some sort of supermodel, I think, because they want all out. Anyway, if I can recommend one film to you today, it's Scrooged. I don't know if you've seen Scrooged, but that's a good one. Yeah. It's very similar. Yeah. I think Bill Murray plays a Jim Morrison character. Anyway,
think of even Bill Murray's character in Ghostbusters is pretty Jim.
That's
Morrison.
True. You brought it full circle. That's good. Yeah. So where in the world are you, Dan? I don't even know where you are right now.
I'm in Welland, Ontario.
Well, and for sure, is that, but where are you precisely? Are you in your new studio space?
Yes.
What's it called again?
Camera Varda.
And what is the reference there? What does that mean?
Agnes Varda, and because she's the greatest, and I don't know. That was just the two words that went together.
It's nice. There's a song. There's a dedication to the studio on, yeah. I want to say your latest album, but as we're speaking, who knows what's going to happen. I'm going to say one of your latest albums. Am I wrong? Did you slow down a little in 2021? Is it only three records that you put out, or am I missing something?
That's correct. Yeah, that's correct.
How did that feel, being real casual, only putting out three records in 1 year?
Pretty good. I got busy with other things.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah, other people's things, and you know.
Okay. You don't feel, was that relaxing to only put out three in a year?
I don't know. I've never been relaxed.
Do you think, I'm obviously making some silly jokes. For those who don't know, you spent the first pandemic year, 2020, deciding to fight it.
Cranking them out.
I don't know if we've had a conversation since. You know what? You're one of the last bands, people I've ever seen play live music. Because you happened to be in Edmonton, Alberta, just prior to the pandemic. I want to say it was January or February of 2020. Is that with Ancient Shapes, maybe? I know it's probably a blur for you, but do you remember we went to that? It was the Rec Room.
I do remember that, yeah.
And we were in that green room space.
Weird upstairs green room, yeah.
Yeah. So you're one of the last people I saw. And then after the lockdowns happened, you started churning stuff out. Initially, it was like weekly, right? Almost. You were putting something out about once a week.
Yeah.
And people were like, this is amazing. But then it also became kind of like...
That's the thing. That's why I stopped. It was just like, it's not sustainable, you know?
Well, there was that thing. But I know you're conscious of people, I don't know, talking about you in a way that maybe is not about the thing you make. It's more about the way you make a thing or whatever. Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, like the idea of being prolific can be demeaning.
Yeah. It was almost like, what are we supposed to do? With this guy, what do we do with this guy? This fucking guy, he can't stop making records, you know. And that's the attitude that I heard.
Yeah.
And then people, I thought, do you think that was distracting people from actually focusing on the music itself or the poems or whatever you were releasing?
Well, I don't know. Like, I mean, shy of you and a few other people, I don't think many journalists focus on the actual music anyway.
You think so? They just want to.
Yeah, I think they want a story or whatever. Hmm. You know, you got to make up stories now to go with your records.
Was there
get any attention?
But was there? So I can't see you thinking this will be a fun story. You just were doing what came natural. And I think some of that stuff, by the way, like you'd had it in the, it was on the shelf. You just got it off the shelf, right? It wasn't like you were making. Was there? No, was there?
I think it accidentally became my best story, though.
Well, I think it was actually. I get what you're saying about people obfuscating the music by talking about whatever else they want to talk about, which is a trick.
Cabin in the woods or whatever. Yeah. Everybody makes their records in cabins now. But they don't.
They went to a cabin.
Say they do.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right. But I do think that first of all, was any of that stuff reflective of the time, or was it all kind of back shelf stuff that you were like,
I would say over 50%. There was maybe two things. The first thing that came out was basically finished, but I had worked on it just prior to getting back from whatever tour. It was pretty fresh.
Yeah.
It was pretty fresh.
Well, there was part of me, and I think I articulated this somewhere. It felt to me that this was, I viewed it all as very hopeful. In the face of complete darkness and uncertainty, I don't know if you did this for yourself to feel feelings and sane and distracted, maybe even from the world. Was there any impulse within you? I know that you, as a person who makes music with a following, it's for you, but it's, you know, you have people who need it. I'm sure there's part of you that realizes that you have a fan base that appreciates what you're doing. So was there any part of that output that felt like something that you thought might be a balm for whatever all you and everyone was kind of going through?
I think releasing music in general, hopefully the outcome is that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess so.
Well, I mean, like, you could have, most people, if you were on like a major record label, they'd be like, no, We can't handle this. We can't handle like a once a week, a couple records a month. We can't do that. We can't market it. We can't blah, 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 blah. You're oversaturating.
Yeah.
But I thought that you were doing it purposely to keep us all happy. And
well, it's a weird thing that's never come about in my lifetime before, where, you know, you know that there's the majority of people with nothing but attention.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And you couldn't tour. You had to do
exactly.
Something.
Yeah.
And did it work out? Like, that's a lot of effort for you. Was it sustainable? Like, I know it wasn't sustainable creatively, probably. You're like, I can't keep doing this. And not all of it was pressed, right? Some of it was digital. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. So was it
almost all of it?
Almost all of it? Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. It was a year ago and time is moving quickly.
There were actual records that came out throughout all of that, but yeah, anything that the majority of it was digital only.
Yeah. Well, I just want to say I think I might have texted you thank you or something, but I just want to say, as a fan and as a person going through the world, it was appreciated. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's nice. Thank you.
Yeah, you know who wouldn't have done this? Selfish Jim Morrison. He wouldn't have done this.
No way.
He would have been wearing
one on vacation.
Now, your band, The Outfit, is amazing. I've seen them. I've seen this configuration actually maybe only once at Lee's Palace with the Sadies. Entirely possible, right? Because the last time I saw you was Ancient Shapes.
Ancient Shapes, yeah.
Some of the same people, not everyone.
Yeah.
Just for the folks listening at home, tell the folks at home who's in the Daniel Romano outfit right now.
The outfit, yeah. It's David Nardi on guitar, Roddy Rossetti on bass guitar, Giuliano Rianlino on vocals, Carson McCone on vocals and auxiliary percussion, and my brother Ian Romano on drums.
Right.
That is 5 plus me equals 6. That's right.
Is this the most steady configuration, besides Ancient Shapes, is this the most steady configuration you've worked with as a solo artist in some time? Or is it, I know some of these.
Yeah. It feels complete. It feels where I've always wanted it to be, or dreamed even that it could be.
Yeah.
It is there now. And we almost got to show people that the other day.
Yeah, I was telling you before we started rolling that I often talk to your friend and mine, Steve Lamke, over the texting. And then we had a couple of phone calls. But he, months ago, it was announced that the outfit would be playing two shows with Mets, I think I want to say. Or was it one? Yeah,
two,
something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
At Lee's Palace, I think, in Toronto, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And anyway, months and months ago. When were the shows supposed to happen? December 18th, 19th, something like that, I think.
17, 18. Yeah.
So months prior to that, they were announced, and Steve said something like, Dan's not certain they're going to happen because of the... And by that point, like, things had been going well in terms of the pandemic. Things were starting to loosen and open up. Lockdowns were slightly being, you know, loosened up. And then the time comes for you to play with Mets. And then the thing starts to this now as we're speaking, there's the variant and things started to get worse. And the day of, they canceled. You had to cancel the show.
Yeah,
and
I got the phone call at 10 a.m.
So that's like Nostradamus. Like, yeah, that's like some stuff you...
You planned that.
But I mean, is that you just being cynical? I think I would have been the same. Like, I couldn't even...
No, I think I was just being a realist about it. And, you know, I haven't felt... You know, a lot of people have been out touring and whatever. I have mixed feelings about that, and that's their, you know, prerogative. But no one in my crew has felt comfortable doing that. And so we've not done it in the entire duration of this thing. So, you know, we were all wary of the thing anyway. And we had all these backup plans. And, you know, we technically have a tour scheduled for late February, which who knows what will happen. But, you know, we have to have all these crazy plans. Like, it's a wild risk. Obviously, anybody out there doing this knows that. But if anything, you know, if anything happens at your show to anyone at your show or anyone in your crew, the next 2 weeks can't happen.
Yeah, yeah. No, your friend and mine, Spencer Burton, was touring around a little bit, and he happened to be in Edmonton. And like I have not gone to see anyone perform, but I'm surprised when my friends are around. Like, I went to see Mets the next day after they played, just to say hey, And I had made a plan with Spencer, but we didn't connect. And then, like, within a... Like, he was here, I think, for two nights, actually, in Edmonton. Yeah. And then we made a plan to connect, but it never happened. And then, like, within days, I felt lucky because he was fine, I believe. He didn't... He texted,
yeah, he was fine. He, but when he got... You know, he lives in the same... he lives behind me.
Yeah, that's right. You're on the same compound. Yeah.
Yeah. And so he slept at a weird... Trailer? Sketchy hotel when he got home, and then he slept a couple nights in a trailer until he was all clear, and, you know.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's... it's one of these things, like, you know, as we're speaking, I'm going through it with my wife a little bit. Her family's like, what's the big deal? Let's get together for the festivities.
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't think... What? I don't understand what's going on. Like, why... I feel like, recurringly, like, I'm in the Twilight Zone. I'm the one being like, well, no, the numbers are up. Why is it whenever they go up, there's a call to gather? And and they're doing the specific wording now is we will try to hold events, like the event people. They say we'll try to hold events, but half capacity and no concessions. No, we don't want you to have be
and
able
that's
to drink.
Not sustainable, you know, the local, like there's only one music venue in St. Catharines, which is like the local, you know, area here. And they can't open because half capacity is not sustainable to pay the bands. And they will make $0 because they pay the bands 100% of the door, which means they only make money from
the bar,
whatever concession. Yeah. And they can't do that.
Yeah. So is that the place where it's also some sort of brewery, or is that a different place?
No, that's a different place. They're still functioning at half capacity or whatever, but
that's a pretty
small
place.
This place I'm talking about is only for shows. Like, it's only open for shows, you know, like Lee's or somewhere like that.
Yeah, so if I were in a band, I don't think I would... I've been trying to be very logical about all this, and it doesn't feel good. No. As a dynamic performer with a live band that is just... smoking right now, not to quote James Carey. There's a lot of James people on the show, but as you, I know that you are appreciative and cognizant of the context we're in, but on a visceral or primal level, how difficult is it for you to not be on stage right now?
It's, I don't know. I mean, I was so nervous leading up to these shows that almost happened. Like, you know, we did like a dress rehearsal at that place I was just talking about, warehouse.
Oh, yeah, in St. Catharines,
just obviously emptied with Kenny, our sound guy. And, yeah, it just felt so strange and difficult. And I couldn't imagine it. I mean, it's only been, whatever, it's been 2 years since I played on a stage. And, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I miss it, but I also feel so disconnected from it now that I don't even know what to... I know that that synergy and that communion and everything is the point. But, of course, there is an aspect of that you can get from just releasing something into the universe.
Yeah.
But it's, like, immediate and reciprocal in a show setting, obviously. Yeah, I guess I'm just maybe... blocking that out so that I don't miss it so much. I don't know.
Well, it's interesting as a performer, as a musician, before you go on stage, after a while it becomes sort of automatic, but you do shift. Yeah. I feel like if I think of it, and it's been years since I've done it, but like for me, I don't think about it anymore. I just go do it. I just go play the instrument I'm supposed to play, but I don't think about it too much because I've just been engaged with it so long. But at the same time, once you check the mic, like, I know my brain has shifted. Oh, okay, you're performing now. It's one of those things where, like, 5 minutes before a stage time, you could be like, oh, my stomach, I don't feel good. And then you go on stage and it's gone. It's just gone. You're performing and your brain, your whole body shifts. So you, even doing a dress rehearsal, did you have that sensation at all of like, okay, we're playing now, it's different?
Totally. As soon as it's happening, it's strange. Like, I mean, I'm usually just riddled with anxiety anyway, and there's a weird sort of like in between oneself type nature that happens when you're in the moment performing. You know what I mean? Like, I think for anxious people in general, like being in the moment is the hardest thing, and that's why you feel that way.
Yeah.
But when you're forced to, when it's like, you know, every movement and every inflection is dependent on your immediacy, then
yeah,
of course you're going to be in that place and not, you know, so it's that thing. It's just, you know, it's like meditation or anything like that.
Yeah, I guess it would be. You're in a slightly altered state.
Yeah.
But you're also like, it is weird. You're, when you look out, you're focused on what you're doing, but you're actually hyper aware of everything going
totally.
On.
Yeah.
Like if someone's having an issue in the crowd, you somehow your mind can still find that as you're singing. So I imagine, yeah, I'm sure there's performers. I haven't talked to any too many people who've done it, but they must be on stage being like, there's a fucking pandemic right now and I'm singing this song. Like, what the hell?
Totally, yeah.
It's got to be weird, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, I know you just did, I keep saying Your Friend and Mine. That might be the subtitle of this podcast, but Your Friend and Mine.
It's just about Steve?
No, actually, in this case.
Oh.
One of my recent guests was Julie Dwaran.
Oh, yes. Okay.
And you guys made a record together.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful. Fantastic. Are you happy with it? Are you happy with the way everything turned out there?
Truly, yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah, because you kind of just played guitar mostly, some percussion. And
yeah.
Yeah. Was that okay? You were okay? Did you produce? Were you like, eh?
Not really. No? We just kind of did what needed to be done. She had the songs ready and we were in like some, you know, Bombardier owned chalet in Quebec somewhere.
Bombardier owned it?
I think so. Yeah. Like the family. Maybe I'm making that up, but I'm pretty sure that's true.
Right. The recording was made somewhere in Quebec is basically what you're saying.
Yeah,
it wasn't,
yeah.
Wasn't even Montreal, right?
No, it was like an hour north of
right.
Montreal.
So my point of that there, beyond the record being great, you played shows, right? You actually did play some shows as a band with Julie.
Three shows as a guitar player for Julie Dwaran, yeah.
So what was that like on a sensory level? Because that was only, as we're speaking, what, two, three weeks ago, right?
Yeah, and it was three in a row. It was so weird.
It
okay,
was.
So this is how it went. You know, in retrospect, thinking back, it was like the first show was like completely alien, and then the second show, it was at the Horseshoe. The second show, so I was like, okay, this like I know this. You go in the back, and you go here, and you know, stand there, and it was just like, okay, well, this is like feels kind of like something.
And normal. Felt normal.
Yeah. Ish. And then the second show was a weird hybrid of those two things. It was at Sala Rosa in Montreal.
Right.
Where there is no sort of escape from the green room, right?
Yeah, that's right.
That's the other thing. Like, you never think about these things. Well, I mean, to a degree you do.
Sala Rosa, the green room's like down some steps, right? Like it's...
Well, there is one down there, but there's like a beside the stage one.
Oh, there is. Oh, yeah, that's right. Okay. Yeah, yeah,
So regardless, you have to go into the audience at some point.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So there's a lot of not eating, not drinking water so that you don't ever have to go to the bathroom, you know, which is a weird tour thing anyway. You're doing long drives and you just don't even drink water.
That's right.
You know,
that's not good. Dan, I'm worried about you. I drank water.
Well, I drink a lot of water, but I have to pee a lot if I drink
I see.
Water
that's
on
like
a drive,
a,
and it's just like...
In the Michael Azerrad book, Our Band Can Be Your Life, when he talks to... there's a chapter on Minor Threat, but there's also a chapter on Fugazi. And Ian MacKaye's only real tour advice is drink a lot of water.
I mean, that is good advice.
But you're right. If you're driving and you're in a hurry, the...
That's all he says?
I think that was the only... No, I haven't read that book in a while. I believe it is, though. My philosophy, yeah, having read that, but also toured, was drink a lot of water, pack some unroasted, like dry almonds.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
I have... When I was the tour guy, I would have a bag of like bulk barn or whatever almonds,
yeah,
and water. And then... but I shouldn't say this. I'm not some... I'm no pun intended. I'm not totally a health nut. Every once in a while, you get your bag of chips or your candy bar,
sure,
or your Coke or your
happen.
Caffeine drink,
yeah,
because you know you got a long drive. But one of the last big tours I did, they mocked me for my almonds and my water. But then by, you know, a week in, they're like, oh, that's a good idea, actually.
Totally. Well, we're all sick.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're not.
Exactly.
Yeah, totally.
So anyway, yeah. I'm sorry that was surreal playing those shows. I just wondered if that's your real first taste of we're back in lockdown mode, I think, but post-lockdown, those were your first real shows. And
yeah, and the trouble, too, is I think in some way I built it up in my head as this like sort of like, you know, it's going to be this triumphant return for myself, like just for myself, not like as an entity to the world, but just for myself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Yeah, I mean, obviously that didn't happen.
Well, but I would think your first crack at normalcy in terms of what you do for a living happening as a side person, that's a nice way to get your feet wet again, isn't it?
I did also. That's where I settled into once I got over myself.
Yeah. Okay.
And it was, you know, it was enjoyable. I mean, I love Julie and I love being around her.
Yeah.
So that was easy. And she came down here and we rehearsed here the day before. And that was nice.
Yeah.
And hanging out with her and Danny.
Yeah. No, it's a fantastic record. We had a good chat and she spoke very highly of you and your brother Ian and Danny. And I'm very happy that all that took place. Speaking of Julie's, this is sort of a segue. I want to ask mm-hmm. you a little bit about Juliana because I've become slightly obsessed with her Cobra Poems lead vocal takes.
Yeah.
I've always, since I think the Sadie show I saw with you guys opening at Lee's Palace a few years ago now, I think that might have been my first exposure to Juliana on stage with you.
Yeah.
Was that early days for you or is just... That was
yeah.
Early?
I mean, yeah. She didn't even get to... You know, we were doing our first real tour when we had to cut it short. So she, you know, we've barely had her in the performance game for at all, really.
Yeah.
You
know? Well, I mean, and she does music on her own as well,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Is it just under her own name or does she have like a project?
Yeah.
Project
yeah.
name? No.
She's got an EP out under JR, but going forward, she's just going as Juliana Riolino.
Yeah. So the songs, hang on a second. I'm going to grab mm-hmm. it here as a visual aid. This is a copy of Cobra Poems that
oh,
I had
looks
here.
Looks good.
Yeah,
looks
I'm
really good.
Showing it to you. It's in the plastic stuff there, but it's unsealed. Don't worry. Is it reflective? Can you actually see it? Anyway, my point.
I can see it, yeah.
This doesn't matter to anyone listening. But the songs that come to mind in terms of what I was just saying are The Motions.
Mm-hmm.
And Tears Through a Sunrise. Am I missing something? Are those?
I think it's just those ones. Yeah,
fantastic. And I want to talk to you first about sort of seating the microphone. What mm-hmm. what prompted that? Did you write those songs, or did she write those songs? How did this all come about?
I wrote them.
Yeah,
I mean, all of that happened quickly. We decided to build this studio, and as soon as it was finished, we were like, okay, we need to do something here and test it out, basically. So I just banged those songs out real fast. And Jules was like still a fresh member and just trying to like make her feel comfortable and find her voice and her place in the group. And I was sort of trying to, you know, help that along in whatever way I could or whatever. And, it was just kind of an in-the-moment decision. You know, we were running the songs together, and I hadn't learned to play them yet because I wrote them, so I wasn't thinking about how they go.
Oh, okay.
So when we were running them, I asked Juliana to sing them so that...
So you didn't have to, basically, so you could concentrate on
exactly.
playing? Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And then from that, I was like, oh, this is something I've always wanted to happen anyway, so just like take it.
Well, I don't know what it is, but I'm completely smitten with those two songs on the record, and it's not just because they are anomalous to my normal Daniel Romano experience. I assumed you wrote them. I was looking at the lyrics for every song last night, and you're really firing on all cylinders again, if I might say. Like, really great. It makes me wonder what some of the things are about, and maybe we can talk about that, but I also don't want to ruin it for anyone. But my point, though, is first of all, but Julian is like a partner in the band, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Everyone's equal.
No. Any, sorry, she isn't she married or something to someone?
Oh, yes, she is. Yeah. Yes, yeah,
yeah. So her entry into the band is it because of it's with
nope,
the
they, no that was the marriage was later.
The marriage was later, but you did you know who did you know first? Is I guess my question. That's what I'm getting at. Who
actually, technically, I knew Juliana before I ever knew Roddy. Yeah.
Okay, but then you say okay, but she. You always thought she would be a backup singer mostly, and then right. I mean, I'm basing this on my one experience.
The way I think about it, and I guess the way I always sort of imagined it was like co-lead singer.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So what does that say about you, Dan? Like you, we all know your projects as Daniel Romano. This one's called Daniel Romano's outfit. Your name is...
I'm slowly trying to, like, you know, it's just wanted to be the outfit, and I'm just, like, working towards that.
We talked about this the last time you were on. There was already a band called The Outfit.
That's okay. They're less popular.
I don't know who they are. They were around for a while. I was in a band called Nathan Cole's Outfit and Guelph, but they're long, long gone, so you don't have to worry about us. That's what my lawyer said.
Yeah.
So you're saying that this impromptu decision with Jules could lead to more such songs, like on an Outfit record. Okay.
Totally.
What about anybody else in the band maybe coming up to the mic?
Yeah, I mean, like, here's the thing. We made on Cobra Poems, my wife Carson, we did this sort of Queen trick where basically Carson and Jules were singing the same part for each part of the harmony into one microphone. I hate giving away tricks, but that's what was happening.
Why do you hate giving away tricks? That's the whole point of the show, is to give everyone the tricks.
Yeah. But anyway, so we were doing that and, I don't know. There's a lot of interesting voices in the band. Dave Nardi has a really interesting and beautiful voice too.
Yeah.
And he does a bunch of singing. A thing we've done recently, I don't know if Steve sent it to you, but a super private sort of exclusive thing that maybe you're in the know of exists, and everybody has a lead section. And it's just like so much more fun.
No, you know? I imagine.
Because I love singing harmony too. Like I write all the harmony parts.
Right.
And I usually have to like go in and record them all and then be like, this is your part, and we break it up, and you know, and I love doing that. So to be able to execute, you know, these four parts in a live setting is sort of the absolute, you know, culmination of my dreams.
No, that's great. And you are, but you are, no matter what happens at the time, for the time being, you're such a gifted poet and lyricist. Are you still going to be like these? You're going to write the songs. Is that still the plan?
Yeah.
Okay. That's fine. You don't have to, you said that almost sheepishly. Like,
I did, but I was thinking, like, is that rude or whatever? But also at the same time, everybody else has their own thing where they do, you know.
Yeah. So did any of this, when you give a song to a singer, and you say you come up with the harmonies and whatnot,
Do
you have input on the phrasing? Do you have input on, or vice?
Sometimes, but sometimes I'm pleasantly surprised with, when other people do things that have anything to do with anything that I'm doing, it's always such a thrill because I have my impulses and they can very easily bore me or just be, you know, it's like, of course I would do that or whatever, you know. So when other people bring their instincts to the table, it goes beyond my thing, or it goes beyond like the genesis of my idea or whatever, and becomes something I could not have achieved alone.
Does a singer or a vocalist that's handling one of your songs ever give you some feedback or suggest a lyric? I'm rewatching the Get Back documentary.
Yeah.
About the Beatles and their sessions to make Let It Be. And at one point, have you seen this, by the way?
I have, yeah.
You have seen it? Okay.
I have, yeah.
We'll talk about this in a second.
Okay.
I actually was able to engage Steve Albini in a discussion, a surprising discussion about the Beatles and Get Back, because I didn't know what he was going to say, because, you know, if you know Steve, he might be like, fucking mainstream.
Totally. Yeah,
but he was like totally sweet and it's not a spoiler alert. It's already happened. The episode's out and circulating, and a lot of people were shocked. He talked about his interactions with Paul McCartney and George Harrison. And I was just like, what? I had no idea. But he was very sweet. Anyway, the point I was trying to make is, do you remember the scene where Paul's working on, I want to say it's A Long and Winding Road, and their roadie, Mal Evans, is like, what if you say waiting or standing? He's like, you think so? And I'm like, what the hell? I didn't know that roadie would be that comfortable to go up to. The other thing that bothers me about,
I mean, he was with them forever.
No, I know. He's basically, you know, one of the funny things in music, the cliches, is the fifth Beatle.
Yeah.
Who's the fifth Beatle in Daniel Romano's Outfit? I know that numerically that doesn't make any sense, but my point is, like, people always like, who's the auxiliary? George Martin's the fifth Beatle. Who's the fifth Beatle? Yeah. But, like, you watch that and you're like, there's like 9-10 Beatles. Like, everyone sort of...
Everyone in the building is a Beatle.
They're so human. They're so beautifully human, that band. That's what I really love about them. Like, I've loved them mm-hmm. my whole life as a fan, and I've read everything, yeah. and I've watched everything, and I know a lot about them. But you watch that thing, and you're like, oh, my God. Such... I think they all... Except George. I don't know what was going on. They all...
he gets over it.
He does. But he's mad. He's rightfully mad. Yeah. He's sick of being the, you know, the... He was like a fifth Beatle somehow, and he's
totally.
In the band.
Yeah.
Anyway, I get where he's coming from, but he comes across crabby, and I think maybe rightfully so. But I also have a lot more sympathy for Paul. John's high as hell, like, and not he hasn't written any songs. Yeah. But my point is, like, such beautifully open humans to the people around them, and I feel like, you know, these days, people like that would be complete prima donnas. They couldn't help it.
Oh,
they don't
totally.
Even realize that they're not self-aware about how they're treating people. These guys are just blokes, just like cool guys. Yeah. Like, yeah, I'm open.
I wonder how much of that has to do with the fact that they hadn't played a show in like many years at that point.
Oh, they didn't have to deal with crap? Or what?
Or just like the whole, like, you know how people can get swept up in like...
Oh, right.
Obviously they're the Beatles. They're famous, but like they're also so insular and have been for so long. Maybe they've just been removed from that, like the impulse to even be a prima donna.
Oh yeah, the hero worship was gone, because if you're not around 15
and even in those sections where they're interviewing people on the street, everyone's so cavalier. It's like, it's not like, oh my God, you know, it's not Beatlemania. It's just like, yeah, I like the Beatles.
Yeah, I like Paul. I'm here to see if they show up. And then they show these those two women in the waiting outside of the Apple building for them to just pull up, and they drive themselves in their cars, except for John and Yoko. But the rest of them drive themselves up, and they go in by themselves. There's like a camera across the street, and the two women who claim they're just waiting for a sight of them don't even do anything.
They don't even do
they're
anything.
They're British. They're just very British people. Yeah. And they're just like, yeah, everything's fine. Whatever.
There they are. We saw them.
That's it. I'm not going to bother anyone. Nothing's a big deal. The Britishness probably has something to do with it. My point here about all of this, do people who are singing your songs, Dan, make suggestions? Do they suggest like, well, why don't you try this? Or I don't know about this line. Has that ever happened?
No. It's never happened, but I don't think so, but I'm open to that.
Yeah.
And I think the issue is we haven't really done that enough to even get to that point yet.
Right.
But the way we're functioning now, that's more likely to occur, I would say.
Okay. No, I feel like you would be open to that too, but I also know you're...
But I also feel like I just have this like sort of like really deep mutual respect with everybody involved, and these people, for whatever reason, trust me and my various impulses, and just are there to add their thing to whatever needs, whatever may be required.
Well, I think to be a visionary in a leadership position, you do have to. That can be tricky, to be open to suggestions and notes, if you will. So I appreciate that you seem to have a level head.
Well, I think that even, you know, the reality is I would do everything instinctively different than anyone else in the band naturally does it.
Yeah.
And so no matter what, if I make a record alone, it's going to be different than an Outfit record.
Yeah.
And that's the thrill of the Outfit. That's why, like selfishly speaking, that's what makes it exciting, is like, oh, I would never do that on the bass, or I would never play the drums that hard, or whatever.
That's your brother. Yeah. No, that makes sense. So these songs, we were talking about kind of the temporal context for the work that you released in 2020. The Cobra Poems, you seem like a person who writes and puts stuff out pretty quickly, meaning like it's of the moment mostly.
Right.
Are these songs reflective, are the Cobra Poems songs reflective of pandemic life per se?
They were created intentionally to have fun.
Yeah.
That's how I wrote those songs. I was like, what is the funnest kind of thing that we can do right now? Which is why it's basically just a rock and roll album.
Is that are you talking arrangement wise or lyrically?
Both.
Yeah, they seem fun.
It's like, I think so. I mean, like, I try, you know, I have an impulse to be sarcastic in lyric. And I'm trying to get away from that and just be thoughtful.
Sarcastic? Ironic? What do you mean sarcastic exactly?
Yeah, like, you know, talk about something negative, but not right on the nose, but instead sort of like take the persona of the wrongdoer or something like
that.
Yeah,
you do that. I mean? You've done that a few times. I was also listening to, so one of the three albums is the live record, which, hang on. No, that's the wrong one. Here it is. So the live record that came out this year is fully plugged in.
Mm-hmm.
There's a nice note from Steve Lamke there. What does it say?
Oh, thanks,
Vish. It just says, thanks, Vish. That's nice. Anyway.
3 exclamation points.
I was listening to this one. I was listening to this yesterday, too. And one of the songs, The Pride of Queens, you and I talked about it when that record came out. But you have a tendency to write about people and things that bother you in withering terms.
Yeah, sure.
So, is there any of that, like
a particular injustice?
Injustice towards punk rock. Yeah, you're not happy about that stuff. But there's like a song like "Holy Trumpeteer," which I couldn't tell if that was sarcastic, for example.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And then you know, these days when you see the word Trump in anything, you're like, what? I know that.
That was not intentional. But I did realize. I realized after the fact that people might think.
I don't mean to get too into this, but who influenced "Holy Trumpeteer"? Is it worth saying? Or who or what?
It's no particular person. It's more a lifestyle.
A lifestyle.
Yeah.
Okay.
I would say so.
What kind of lifestyle? Like
the kind of lifestyle that you could only attain by having skewed values.
Okay. Again, I don't want to ruin anything, but I like maybe if we stick it out and stuff. A lot of babies.
Well, yeah. Well, Jules and I try to baby it up as much as possible.
We actually
have a sort of baby competition where who can say the most babies on stage.
So baby, for those who don't know, baby is a term that has been invoked in rock and roll since at least the 1950s.
It's a rite of passage. Yeah.
It's a rite. You just say baby, and you're usually referring to a loved one of your own age. It's not actually a small baby, but
our whole crew address each other as baby.
Now, what is that about? Well, it's one of those, like watching the Get Back thing again, the Beatles thing, you realize, someone pointed this out to me the other day, one of the things that's interesting about the Beatles is that they were doing stuff that we now view as cliche kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Maybe, like I said earlier, I don't feel that way. I don't think they indulged in stuff that is shameful or so hackneyed or spinal tappy, but no one had done as a band what they had done, meaning no one had gotten that famous, no one had affected that much sociocultural political change, and they, as you watch that, it's the end of basically a 6-year run of that, so they barely had time to process what they've done.
Yeah,
they can't possibly.
I'm sure they hadn't at all. There's no
that
way
really
have.
Really fascinating moment where Paul McCartney alludes to the fact that 50 years from now people are going to say that Yoko Ono broke up the Beatles by sitting on an amp.
Totally.
That worked on for me. That was hugely shocking. I'd never seen that footage before, as a lot of us hadn't.
Yeah.
Some of it's circulated in bootleg form, but I hadn't seen that part before, and it resonated with me on two levels. One, holy shit, he was right. How could you be in the moment in 1969 with that relationship? With John and Yoko, they'd only been together a couple years.
Yeah.
Who could... And that's all that's happened since then. People scapegoat Yoko. The other part of it is, like, who has the gall to think that people will be talking about them in 50 years? Like, the self-awareness worked for me on two levels, and I was just blown away by it. So...
Yeah, on some... I mean, so many things were invented for them because of the enormity that they became.
Yeah.
Out of pure necessity, you know, as all invention is. So they, you know, that in itself must have made them aware to some degree that, like, okay, like, there is an entire new apparatus because of us, you know, because of what, regardless of whether we made it happen or the universe made it happen or whatever it is, like, it is happening and we are the center point of this new thing.
Yeah.
So I feel like no matter what, on some level, you have to be cognizant of that.
Well, we say baby is just like a rock and roll word. It just became a rock and roll word. And
totally.
And I feel like it's just one of those things that over time, It's like there was a point in the mid to late 90s where I worked with a guy that I didn't like at a self-serve gas station, and he always said, dude, can you fill in for me, dude? Can you take my shift, dude? And I used to hate it because I don't know, I associated dude with something dumb. But now I say dude, and everyone says dude. It never went away, and baby never went away. So I...
there's certain things. I mean, somebody at Shoppers Drug Mart the other day he was working there and crossed my path, like bad timing, turning a corner multiple times. And both times he's like, sorry, boss.
Yeah, boss, that's a horrible
boss
one.
Is rough.
Boss
I
is
do
bad.
Not like it.
Yeah,
I don't like
chief,
it.
Chief, boss, these are bad.
Chief is bad on many levels.
One of the disgraced CBC hosts that whose name we dare not say whenever I ran into him, I feel like he didn't remember
my
name.
I'm sure he said something super stupid.
No, he would always call me boss or chief, and I realized it's because he couldn't remember my name.
Yeah. It's a cop-out.
And I didn't like that. So, yeah, I get it. I get what you're saying there. My point in the babies thing, though, and you say fun record... You know, Dan, you put out records, and sometimes people can't help
them. They're fun.
They are fun.
Sometimes they're fun.
They're always, I think, quite fun. We haven't even talked about the less fun version of a record that you put out this year, maybe. Maybe we should do that at some point, too. I thought it was still pretty fun. But my point is, you put out records, and the easy thing for someone in my position, let's say, not necessarily me, but they might be like, well, this sounds like that, and this sounds like this, or, well, clearly he's going for this. And in covering you, I probably said, oh, well, this reminds me of Rolling Thunder Review Dylan or something, just because I thought you were attacking things in with a certain ferocity. Not necessarily that it sounded like it. I just thought the spirit was there.
The spirit, sure.
So the spirit that I hear on this, and forgive me in advance, there's some stone stuff happening here.
Yeah,
is that fair? Was that an influence at this particular time?
I feel like it'd be crazy if you didn't hear that.
Okay, well, I just don't like pigeonholing you or people generally by saying it's any one thing.
But it's that, you know, it was like, okay, what's that sort of like, you know, sort of lavish, indulgent spirit of rock and roll that makes it dangerous and fun and, you know, and those things just like instinctively appeared when we got together with the uniformed attitude of that. As the goal, you know.
But you got a horn section on a couple of songs. Like, a horns appear, and the riffs are more, I would say, you know, they're in that zone, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, totally.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, it's brilliant stuff, though. Like, I think that sort of Sticky Fingers era of the Stones that I hear here, that whole run, like, it is weirdly fun and dark. Because,
totally.
Like, oddly enough, I feel like that time, if you think about that run they were on with those three or four records, which, off the top of my head, what would they be? They would be Beggar's Banquet, Let It Bleed, Sticky Fingers, and Exile, right? Like,
Exile,
that's, those are the ones. And then Goat's Head Soup, I think, is a bit lost. And I don't...
This is a turning point.
I know, but I thought that was good.
I think it's good, too.
It's something that gets lost, and everyone's like, those four, that's it. I'm like, really? Like,
no, but I do think, like, I think the pinnacle being, or the summit being Exile, I would say.
I love Exile. I have a soft spot for Sticky Fingers.
Sticky Fingers is unbelievable. I think that maybe the unintended parallel between Cobra Poems and Exile would be the forced isolation aspect.
Yeah, they were in Paris making a record literally in Exile.
Totally. Not to compare the album to Exile is clearly inferior,
don't sell yourself short, first of all. But secondly, I feel like, so I don't know what it is about my brain, but I went to Sticky Fingers with this one more than Exile. Okay. But I see what you're saying. The spirit is similar. And Precipice of Change, like cataclysmic change, like imagine,
totally,
you know, 69, 77, like just imagine being in that zone where, again, like you watch the Beatles movie and they're having conversations about Martin Luther King's assassination after it has just happened. Like, it's just sort happened. Of weird observing people in history, processing it relatively in the moment, stuff that we just all now view as monumental. And so I'm sure Jagger and I mean, the Stones were kind of all over the... Well, Exile was a disjointed record. They weren't always around and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So they were in exile. They're fleeing the British tax code and all that stuff, and they makeshift studio. Everything was a bit ramshack. Sometimes not everyone showed up. It's like a fucked up record. That band fucked up when not everyone showed up.
Yeah, totally.
So Exile is, Exile, I used still to say happening. Exile was my favorite, but I have the coherence of Sticky Fingers is starting to resonate with me more somehow. I don't know. I just need the comfort of it. If I had a favorite song, it might be Can't You Hear Me Knocking?
Like, that's perfect.
It is.
It's perfect.
And there's like, when I hear Baby, If We Stick It Out, I hear little production elements of like that era of the Stones.
Totally.
And so I get where you're coming from is all I'm getting. So it's a fun, fun record. But
of course, and you know like how these things work. It's not like citing. It's not like we're citing this and then doing that. It's just like we're people who are students of music doing a thing. Here's the general aesthetic and it just happens. You know?
Yeah. Right. Okay. So the other record that isn't the live record that I already put away that you released this year, I think it was only digital. What was that record called?
Oh, Kissing the Foe.
Yeah. That came out in 2021, right?
I think so.
So that is that you? That's just you.
That's just me, yeah.
Right. But it's not Ancient Shape. So that's, I mean, you do this too sometimes. You make a solo record and like you're one of the few people, if they make a solo record, it's pretty much all you. Is that the case for that one?
Yeah.
Okay. And does that?
I can't remember if there's horns or something. I'd probably hired somebody. But
are you picking up horns? I wondered about that. I know you cited Aaron Hutchinson as the trumpet player on Cobra Palms.
I may have had him do stuff on, or maybe I used a mellotron. I don't remember. But if there's real horns, then it's probably Hutchie.
I know you're pretty much an in the moment guy, and this is probably a trite question, but like, is there a zone for you where you're like, how do you know, again, if something's for you, Outfit, Ancient Shapes? Like, to do that, is there any rationale behind it, or is it just whatever you're feeling like doing?
Yeah, those are three different sort of emotions, I think. And time is something that factors into what it will be, you know, depending if... or the need for solitude or not, or things like that.
I mean, mode-wise... When the last time we talked about Ancient Shapes, you told me something like, often it's just the drums are set up in mics, so you go play drums for 2-3 minutes, and then you decide later what the other stuff's going to be musically. And then do you improv the lyrics?
For Shapes, sometimes. I usually have like titles.
Right. But when you get on the mic, you hit record, and you just go for it.
I'm not like Jay-Z kind of thing. I'm more like I'll have like, you know, I can't do that. That's like one of the most baffling things to me is what do they call that?
That he just goes in with nothing?
Freestyle.
He claims he goes in with nothing. And then you watch that.
He's the only rapper to rewrite history without a pen, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Only rapper to rewrite history without a pen. Yeah, absolutely. I like that album, The Blueprint 3. Mm. No one really... Do you like that one? It's got some bad stuff on it. Do you know it?
I don't know it, no.
That's when I saw him and I got to meet him, was when he released that record.
Yeah.
And the folks at the CBC who did that big show with the guy who's not there anymore.
Yeah.
Jay-Z was due to be there on a Saturday. And I worked at CBC, but in a totally different department, right? So I was friends with everyone at that show. And the main producer on it was like, it's just going to be me and the host. And I know you know a lot about Jay-Z. Like, can you vet the script? And I said, okay. So they sent me the script and it was wrong. Like, this stuff was just biographically wrong. And I thought the questions weren't... I punched it up.
Yeah.
And I fixed it. And then they said, can you... So he's coming in on Saturday. He's doing a little round of press he was playing at the Air Canada Center.
Yeah.
Which is what the arena was called at the time. Can you come in? We don't want it to just seem like we have nobody working here. Can you come in and just be there? And
you're just a stand-in like, person?
Yeah. So my wife and I are going to see the show
in
the
evening.
Yeah, we're going to the show anyway. I'm like, yeah, absolutely. So I go in and you know, the disgraced host guy is being himself. And he's like, I will just sit. I will not greet him. I will sit. It'll be a big, like he had like a whole psychology of how he dealt with people.
I remember.
Yeah, you would know. Anyway, so Michelle and I are there, and my colleague says, "If you could, one thing you could do, if you don't mind, like, could you make him some tea? Like, we just gotta have stuff ready." Like, she wanted us to help. It wasn't.
Yeah.
She needed help. It was a Saturday, and I'm like, "Yeah, absolutely." And I'm surprised. I would think a whole gaggle of producers would be like, "Jay-Z's coming in.
Here,
fuck
like,
that. I'm coming in
work.
On my day off."
Yeah,
right.
Totally. Yeah.
So Michelle makes Jay-Z. Sean Carter, some tea,
what kind?
Probably whatever. I doubt it was Orange Pico. Whatever they had, maybe some herbal tea.
Herbal,
I don't remember.
Yeah.
Lemon I don't ginger. Know if he had a rider or anything. I don't remember.
I feel like he's probably a lemon ginger guy.
Well, nowadays, yeah, probably. It'd have to be some sort of vegan tea because of Beyonce. Anyway. Yeah.
Is she vegan?
Beyonce. I think they've been experimenting with it, and they did a whole thing where they were vegan for like a month, and then it probably stuck. Why not?
Anyway. Truly the Paul and Linda of our time.
They are. I think they are, actually, yeah. So, well, I'm not... I would say Beyonce's on a higher level than Linda. No,
yeah, I guess.
No,
yeah.
No offense to Linda McCartney. Rest in peace.
I meant that like Beyonce is Paul.
Oh,
and Jay-Z is maybe Linda.
That still, I don't know. Anyway, I'm holding the studio door open, and Jay-Z and his gaggle of people come in, and so I'm holding the control room door open. I don't know why. I was just asked to do it, but the studio is like right across the way. So I'm holding the door open, and Jay-Z comes, and I say, hey, huge fan, he shakes my hand. I shake his hand, and he starts to come in the control room, and his gaggle of people are starting to make their way in. I'm like, no, actually, the recording's in there.
Yeah.
So he goes in, and they start to do the interview, and it's pre-taped or whatever. They're recording it for broadcast the following week. Anyway, as an intro, they start playing Empire State of Mind, which by this point I know, as I'm speaking to you, I know all the words to it. But at this point, I don't quite have it. I don't have it nailed down yet. But it's playing, and I'm in the booth doing this. I'm dancing because I can't help it. I love that song. I just loved it. It had just come out, and I think it was a single. It's with Alicia Keys. Anyway, Jay-Z, Sean, he's like rocking out, and he sees me rocking out, and he gives me like a smile because I'm the only fucking one into it. And then they have the interview, and it's fine. And I think my notes helped. Anyway, interview's done. He's got to rush over to Much Music, which at the time was a music station in Canada. I don't think it exists anymore.
Vaguely familiar.
Yeah. So he's about to rush over there. They're going to walk. Just going to walk down Peter Street or John Street. John Street. They're just going to walk down to the Much Music with his little crew and do like a live thing on Much. Anyway, before he leaves, I ask if I can get a photo, and I go into the recording booth, which again, just the now disgraced host and Jay-Z, and I'm asked to take a photo of them with whatever they have. But I ask the now disgraced host if he can take a photo of me and Jay-Z, which he goes, all right. Like that. He kind of says it like, I guess so. He does it. It's a horrible photo. It's dark. I have it. It sucks. Like, it's not great. Yeah, I feel badly about it.
Of course it's bad.
Anyway, then Jay-Z leaves. Oh, and I flash The Rock, which is the Rockefeller.
Yeah.
He's just, he knows I'm a big guy, fan, you know, and we have a nice exchange. Michelle meets him. It's great. What a thrill. But it's just a fleeting thing. But he leaves, and then the disgraced host sort of leaves in a slight huff. I find out later from my colleague, you're not supposed to ask him to take photos of you with the guests. It's a big no-no. I'm like, what? What? I don't know. What was I supposed to do? He's in a rush. Hova was leaving. I had to pin him down.
Yeah.
And he's the only guy there. No one else came in. Yeah. What the hell? I just took a photo of him. Anyway, on a human level, it taught me that day. I'm like, oh, that's what fuck goes on here. You know, like I had an inkling from some colleagues. Anyway, that was my Jay-Z story. Why did I tell you that? I don't even remember.
Prima Donna.
Oh, because of he freestyles. If you watch the documentary about the Black Album, that really hits. Have you ever seen that? The thing with...
No, I haven't.
Holy shit, man. So there's a documentary about the making of the Black Album, and it shows Jay-Z going to work with Timbaland, and Timbaland playing him the Dirt Off Your Shoulder beat for the first time, and Jay-Z makes a face like... He's never heard anything like this before in his life. Do you know the Black Album? Yeah. Do you know that album?
I do, yeah.
Then the most interesting scene, I thought, was Jay-Z goes to make 99 Problems with Rick Rubin, who people might know for his work with the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and Johnny Cash, and Neil Diamond. He's done a lot of projects, and Beastie Boys. Yeah. So in the sequence, Mike D from Beastie Boys is in the studio watching this, and you hear Rick Rubin say... to Mike D, he doesn't write anything down. I've never seen anything like this. He just goes. It's the most ridiculous rapping I've ever seen.
Rick Rubin
says this to Mike D as Jay-Z's in a booth. But fascinatingly for you, I know you like Ian MacKay, I believe. You're a fan of the Minor Threat. Yeah. But I don't believe you love the Fugazi as much. Is that correct? Is that a fair thing to say on the record?
I don't know. That was just for jokes.
You can see behind me, I have a poster of that band. I like them a lot. So my point is...
I like Fugazi.
On the record, it's fair. I know. I'm just... I didn't mean to... Rick Rubin loves them too, and he tries to get Jay-Z to do 99 Problems over a demo from Instrument.
Cool.
Which I believe is, I can't remember off the top of my head.
There's footage of this?
Yeah. So the footage starts.
It's in the documentary.
When you go to the, when it gets, so it's a documentary, so it's scene to scene to scene to scene. When it gets to the part where he's working with, when Jay-Z and Rick Rubin are working together, it starts with a voiceover. This is all from my memory. I could be wrong. I think it's on YouTube. I'll send you the link. Mm-hmm. But there's a scene where Jay-Z in the transition is doing a little voiceover about what he's doing.
Yeah.
And in the background, you hear, I believe it's closed captioned by Fugazi in demo form from the Instrument soundtrack. And you hear Jay-Z trying to do 99, I think it's 99 Problems over it, but it's not working.
Crazy.
And so it's a bizarre, I'll send you the link after this is done. All this to say, you're good at what you do. And the fact that you kind of freelance a little bit when you're stepping up to the mic is baffling to me. But I appreciate that you're not Jay-Z.
Yeah, I couldn't, I don't think I could handle it.
You mentioned Carson McHone.
Mm-hmm.
And that is your life partner.
Truly.
And Carson's a musician in their own right. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
I got a thing from Merge Records saying that on February 25th, there's a record coming out by her called Still Life. Did you have anything to do with the making of this record?
I did. I guess I produced it.
Oh, that's fun. Did you go down to... Where's Carson from? How did you meet Carson?
She's from Austin, but we did it in my living room.
Oh, okay. Oh, not even your studio?
No, studio didn't exist yet.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So and you're married, are you?
Yeah.
And how did you meet?
Touring like many years ago.
Oh, okay, cool. But but you mentioned earlier that she's a fifth outfit. Is she in?
She's in the outfit. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So I don't know if I've seen you. She wouldn't have been at that Sadie show.
To play a show. We were to premiere her, but that didn't happen.
Nice. We talked about your songwriting earlier. I know you're a producer. Did you have a hand in any lyrics or anything? Is this
no,
all
her? No, it's all her. All the songs. She had all the songs in the bag. And, I just lent my sort of rhythmic aesthetic and whatever to the songs to serve them the best I could. And everybody seemed to be happy about it, so...
Now, as carefully as you can, how would you characterize the music that Carson makes? I just now, for those listening, because we've been talking about it, I decided to download the record that I was given, but I don't know anything about it. I haven't had a chance to listen to it.
I would say it's poetic, introspective, whimsical. Some of it's rock and roll, some of it's folk kind of thing.
Okay.
It's pretty in tune with what you might expect a person like me to like. And it's, it's very good. Her lyrics are very, very good. And she's a brilliant singer and song crafter.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate even that little bit of insight, and I'll spend some time with it myself. Knowing what you know of me and knowing what you know of Carson, do you imagine there might come a time where Carson and I might want to have a conversation more in depth about this record? Does that make sense?
I think so. Yeah, okay. It does. Yeah. And I think you'd both enjoy it.
Is she aware of who I am by any stretch of the imagination?
She is, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We've listened to your podcast together.
Really? Oh, that's very kind. I didn't know that was a thing that you would do with your loved ones. That's not what I recommend to people. I say go by yourself and spend time with me and my guests. Don't share it with other people.
Don't do it together.
No, that's great. So that's one thing that, and I assume if you could tour, you will be a part of that, right? You yourself?
Yeah. The plan is it'll be a double bill.
Right.
For the, the stretch of shows that are on the tentative books.
Okay, cool. Anything else on the books for you beyond the stuff there's like I said, three records came out in 2021. As we're speaking, Dan, it's 2022. Or rather, as people, as we're speaking, it's not 2022, but no, as people are listening, yeah, it might be 2022. Any other plans for releases? You alluded to a top secret thing that Steve Lamke should have sent to me, but anything else that we should keep an eye out for?
Yeah, I don't, like, we don't, you know, I realize, like, we don't have, like, sneaky rollout plans like all the bigwigs, or at least, like, we don't, they're not plans, that maybe it happens that way, but so there's some things at the pressing plant. Yeah. Okay. There's a couple things.
Okay.
We're running an archive series, for the records that came out, last year.
Oh, physical copies of, oh,
yeah,
nice. Okay,
yeah,
great.
So, so 2 and 3 will be issued first, which is, which will be, Visions of the Higher Dream and Content to Point the Way. 1 and 2 being the eventual issuing of Nerveless and Human Touch.
Right.
The other records that were digital only and temporary.
The only other thing I want to, I appreciate that. So that's forthcoming stuff is archive.
That's real inclusive kind of exclusive news for you.
Oh, I appreciate that. Now, I don't get a lot. Actually, the last time you were on the show, you told me about records coming out.
Did I spoil something?
No, you just told, you just talked about records that weren't coming out. Like in, I want to say January, you told me about records that didn't end up coming out till October. Oh, or yeah, something, and that was very kind of you. I'm not on an exclusivity level. I was just nice to know what you're up to. I mean, I think probably your fans. By the way, every time you're on the show, I hear from your fans. You're one of those people.
Oh, that's nice.
It's like you and like whenever Andy Schaaf's on, I get emails. Like it's rare to get emails or messages specifically from fans of the of the guests, but it happens sometimes. But yeah, for some reason, you and Andy Schaaf, I get like every time.
Death threats?
No, no, just like, oh, it was interesting you talked about this, but did you consider this? And I'm like, they have theories? It's like the movie JFK. they have the same sort of impulse. The one thing we didn't talk about, I realize, which I'm gathering you had some highlights in 2021, and I bet you knew this was coming. Here, hang on a second. I want to show you something.
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple of things I want to show you. I have this.
Yes.
What is it, Dan? Tell people what it is.
It is the Springtime in New York bootleg series, volume 16 by Bob Dylan.
Yeah, you know what else I have? Hang on, let me show you this. I also have this, which I haven't actually, I unsealed the other one and listened to it, but I also have the what is it called? The 2LP version?
Yeah. Oh, is that the Columbia one? Or Sony, whatever it is.
Yeah, this is the is the one I just showed Dan there, folks, was the Third Man Records sort of...
The Third Man one, yeah.
Do you have any of those?
No.
You don't have...
Maybe I do.
And I also... They sent me the CD version of it, which is in the basement, right, where I'd show that off too, like a glutton.
Yeah, yeah.
Like a horrible Dylan glutton. But... Why, for the folks... Tell the folks at home why I...
Oh, don't make me talk about
okay,
it.
Okay, so here's the thing that happened. I'll tell you. And you tell me. Okay, you just tell me how this felt. I, in my position as Vish Khanna in Canada, mm-hmm, was sent the advanced versions of this. Do you like this collection, by the way, beyond anything else, before we get...
From what I've heard of it, yeah, totally.
You haven't heard the whole thing?
No.
Why is that? Is it not your favorite era?
No. Well, it's not my favorite era, but it's an era that I like.
Yeah, I wasn't sure about it.
I have trouble with box sets these days.
Well, yeah, there's the because of the scale.
I think so. Yeah.
You can
the breadth of it. Yeah.
Well, also the pressing plant backups that these things cause, because the majors don't really have much else to do. You know, they got no product.
Well, that's just, you know, this is how it always goes. The punks do something and then the other people ruin it. So, you know.
Yeah, that's true. So the reason I bring this up is, so in my capacity as being me, I get advanced stuff sometimes. And they sent me a digital version of this box set and the liner notes. And in the liner notes, I noticed with great pride, I don't know how else to describe it, but Dan, you and your band are referenced in the liner notes of a Bob Dylan collection because you... Yeah, it's true. Because what did you do again? You did something very interesting in 2020 on a kind of... It's sort of a joke, but it's also not.
We brought a joke to life, yeah. Something we discussed for years, really. What we did was we did the plugs Letterman Performance version of the entirety of an album for fun.
Now, which record did you do as the plugs? Which Dylan record?
Infidels.
You did Infidels, and why? This is a funny idea, but that performance, I guess I know why. I'm not going to play dumb. I was playing dumb for a couple of things there, but why am I playing dumb? People know I know things. Sometimes I play
they
dumb.
They do, especially about that guy.
So he went on Letterman, which was a rare occurrence, and to my knowledge, he decided he would bring like a pickup band with him, not like whoever he was playing with, and he became enamored of the Plugs. Who were an LA-based sort of punk band, right?
Yeah.
And so not all of the Plugs appear, but some of the Plugs appear with Dylan.
Yeah.
And they run through a number of, what do they do, three songs on Letterman or something like that?
In the actual performance, yeah. I think there's maybe a couple others that are
rehearsal footage.
Yeah.
So it's a cool sound, but I mean, famously, he had the wrong harmonica on stage. He had the wrong key, and there was a big kerfuffle and blah, blah, blah. But I thought that was really interesting for him to do, and I thought it was really fascinating that you homed in on this particular moment in his history and fleshed it out. Like, that's very funny. And they, my understanding is the Dylan camp was aware of this, that you did this. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and they were supportive of it or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you get any actual feedback from them?
You know who we got feedback from was that band, The Nerves.
Yeah.
They, for some reason, liked it. Whoever, somebody from that band, the main dude. I don't remember anybody's name or anything, but that was like notable feedback, I thought. But yeah, we didn't get, I think we got feedback from The Plugs too, somebody from The Plugs.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So my point, though, is I happen to have a sneak peek of this information that you were mentioned in the liner notes. And I wrote you a text and said...
You told me, yeah.
Did I tell you? Was I the first person to tell you?
You were the first person to tell me, yeah.
Did I do it in a wrong way? Because I kind of did it in a...
No, you screamed it. like it was all caps.
I think I said, have you... Because I'm under embargo. I'm not supposed to share certain bits of information, right? So I abide by it because I don't want to shit where I eat or whatever the expression is.
Totally.
So I said, hey, have you by chance... I thought they might tell you. Like, I just thought, given your... The fact that you had a bit of a... You must have had some sort of two-way conversation about even doing it, right? For whatever reasons.
Well, Roddy being the biggest Dylan fan in the group, he was in charge of talking to Dylan's manager
and
people and everything. So, but he wasn't privy to it.
Okay, yeah. And I think...
So they didn't tell us. Maybe they thought we would be happy with a surprise, but...
So how did you feel? You're a fan. I know you're saying Roddy's the biggest fan.
Yeah.
You're a big fan.
Yeah.
I send you the text... And I say, what I said was, hey, have you by chance been told about the liner notes for this thing? And you were like, no. Why? Like, question marks.
Yeah.
And I went, okay, can you keep a secret? And then I pasted, because they sent me like a Word doc of it or whatever. I pasted the blurb for you, and I think you freaked out, didn't you? You freaked out a little?
I was happy about it. But mostly I was like, to be honest, I showed Roddy.
That's the first thing you did?
Yeah.
Was he in the vicinity?
No.
Have you receiving the text, or did you just copy it?
I copied it and sent it to him.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah. I asked, can you keep a secret, and you immediately send it to
immediately
Roddy.
Did not, yeah.
Now, this has a very... I appreciate that you did this, because it has a... First of all, it's over. The album's been out... The box set's been out a long time.
Yeah.
I didn't think telling someone mentioned in it would be a huge crime. What was Roddy... I know it actually has a very sentimental... it had a sentimental impact on Roddy, right?
Yeah, big time. Yeah. He was very, very, very happy about it.
Yeah? Okay. Mm-hmm. He sent me a nice note over one of the social media things to express his thanks. And my understanding is he was able to show this to his father, who subsequently passed away, which meant a lot to him.
Yeah. And he was also very proud of it.
Well, okay, so this is all very sweet and nice. Roddy's not here, so I can't ask him these same questions. But like I said, he conveyed his gratitude towards me, too, that I was... Because you wouldn't have known otherwise. The record was out. I had it a couple months in advance or whatever.
Yeah.
So I just was so excited for you that I wanted to share it with you. And
thank you for doing that.
Yeah, I guess it worked out in a way that I wasn't even aware that it could.
Totally.
But you, personally, Roddy was happy. Viscerally, you were happy. But what did that do to your day? Did it make you particularly excited?
I mean, not much. I mean, it's a weird thing. It's like, okay, well, this is like, you know, it's cool and interesting subculturally, but it's like, you know, it's you know, and at the end of the day, it's sort of like acknowledgement for like a gag.
But isn't that great? But a gag is thoughtful. You like comedy.
Yeah, totally. And also, like, it's not like Bob Dylan hasn't made entire albums that were jokes.
Exactly.
Know?
Yeah.
Like, I don't mean that in a demeaning manner. I mean, like, intentionally.
Yeah, I think he's a jokester. He likes to put on jokes. I feel like most of the things he's done.
Comedy is very necessary in music, I think.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. Well, I can relate to it only in that, and I've talked about this ad nauseum maybe, but I have a certain, I get a visceral thrill whenever the Dylan camp will blurb my reviews.
Totally.
And they'll just mention it, and I'm like, what the? It feels like being seen by someone who you would think, I mean, it's not Bob, but like the fact that, well, at the same time.
Who knows?
Whenever you reach out to a camp like Bob's, whatever I do about some proposal, and often, as you might guess, it's like, again, if he ever, I know he does like one interview every 10 years, but again, I do it for a living and or whatever this is. And and if he ever wants to talk, so I always do that. And every once in a while, it'll be like a project. Hey, the thing I'm working for, the company wants to do something on Neil Young's birthday. And we know Bob loves Neil Young. What do you want to talk? The responses get very specific. Well, we are talking to Bob next week. I'll ask him. So my point is, just on those little glimmers, I'm sure they're like, Bob, here are the reviews. In my case, for example, Bob, here are the reviews that came in for Fallen Angels, your record. We were thinking we would blurb the Los Angeles Times, Rolling Stone, The Guardian, and this guy Vish from Now Magazine. What do you think? And in my mind, it's probably not this at all, but in my mind, he goes, all right, let me take a look at the thing here. That seems good. Sure, go with that.
Yeah.
There's a slight chance my name has entered his brain. And you're just like, holy shit. And similarly, I would think, again, this sounds minor. Every time I bring this up, I do it sheepishly. And the person on the other end is like, no, dude, that's cool. Like, that's a really, you should be excited about that. Because I'm like, you know.
Totally.
Okay. So you were excited.
Yeah. I try not to get too into that, like, idols world, you know, where it's like, obviously I love and appreciate everything that guy's ever done. But at the same time, I try not to put him on a pedestal that doesn't need to exist. Like obviously he's of a higher existence and in a lot of ways, and in a lot of ways he's not. So it's like, I don't know. I ebb and flow with that. Sometimes I'm like, you know.
I mean, if you were tapped to open a show for Bob Dylan, you'd be pretty excited. I gather that part. Like, I'm sure that would be true. However, I'm with you. Like, getting back to the get back thing, I think Dylan has been trying to humanize himself since 1964.
Totally.
And it doesn't always work, so he decides to have fun and fuck around with us a little bit.
Which exacerbates the dehumanization.
Yeah, it does. It just makes him seem like more and more of a character and less of a person because he does all this mysterious shit. But anyway, my point is I was proud.
And along with what I said about comedy, you know, mysticism is also a very important element in music.
It is. And it's...
So I understand that. And I obviously, you know, I partake.
Well, one of my heroes... who passed away in 2021, Norm Macdonald, also employed enigma and mysticism and pseudo-philosophy in his work. Yeah. And it really gave him a stature and a character that I think about all the time, more than most other comedians. Like, it's not just that he was funny, but if you followed him on Twitter or all the stuff he did, he seems to be coming from the same zone as Dylan. Like,
totally.
It's one thing to do a thing and for yourself, but it will also mess with people. It'll leave them wondering more than, you know, any kind of closure. their day is like, what the hell was that? Like, for both those characters, and I think I like that about them too. I don't partake of that myself. I'm pretty much straight as an arrow.
I think the thing about that is, like, understanding is not the point.
Yeah.
you know, understanding can't be the point because there's so little to life that we get to understand anyway.
Yeah.
So the fun is in the mysticism.
Yeah.
And the truth.
Yes, I think it is. There's truth in it too. Well, listen, Dan, we've covered a lot of ground here. I appreciate it. We've talked about all the big heavy hitters in rock history, I think.
Yeah.
And I hope you enjoyed it. I want to tell people, from what I know, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, if people want to learn more about you and your work, they can go to the You've Changed Records site. Is that right?
That's a good starting point. Yeah.
Is there any other place you'd want to send people? You're on the socials and stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. Don't go there. Just go to You've Changed. That's probably best. There's a nice plethora of good things there.
Yeah, and that'll direct people also. You have a Bandcamp and stuff that's always very full, it feels like.
Yeah.
And people can find that. Okay. If we can go out on a song. We didn't even talk about Kissing the Foe. Do you want to say anything about Kissing the Foe just in like 30 seconds?
I don't remember it.
I don't remember either. We talked a little bit about it. Every time we have a ramble, I hope I've done some sort of good job.
The thing I like about whenever we talk is it's never like in like, doesn't seem like it's ever in like support of anything or whatever that means.
Sure.
So it's more genuine that way.
Okay, good. I
got nothing to plug.
I like plugging things. I like to get people on and help them plug things. That's why I do the website stuff and the records. Yeah. But having said that, here's a good way to plug. There's a song from Cobra Poems. Let's pick that. I'm going to pick that one of all the things we've been talking about. There's a song from Cobra Poems that we can go out on.
Mm-hmm.
Can you pick one and tell us why you chose it?
Can you show me the track list? It's so small. Okay, yeah, that's sort of working. No. Oh, you know what I like is, what is it called? Even in the Loom of a Caress? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, that one reminds me of Gandhi, because he used a loom.
Okay.
Even in the Loom of a Caress. Why did that one come to mind?
I just think that was the newest song added to that collection before we made it, so it's my favorite.
Well, what is the meaning behind that phrase, though? I mean, I know it's in the song and it's contextualized there, but where did that's a unique thing to grab as a title, and I just am curious. Do you want to say anything about it?
You know, it's like even in the anticipation or of something, or even in the absence of something.
When it's not,
you know,
an
something's coming, or whether not a loom, like when I'm making a rug or whatever.
No, I know. It's the caress is in the offing.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, we've talked enough, I'm sure, for most people. Let's just play it. This is Daniel Romano's Outfit with Even in the Loom of a Caress from their excellent record, Cobra Poems, which came out in 2021. It sounds like there's more great stuff coming in 2022, so look out for that. Dan, always a pleasure. I love you very much. Thank you for being on the show.
Love you. Thank you.
Best of luck in the future.
Thanks, Vish.
Of an unknown sky. Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Oh, it's always nice to have Daniel Romano on this show. Thanks again to Dan for coming back and appearing this time on the 660th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available wherever you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode that you're looking for, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit my website, vishkana.com. All of Dan's past appearances are somewhere on that website if they're not in your podcast feed there, because there's a limit. But anyway, I'll leave that to you. Vishkana.com for more info about all of that stuff I just said. You can like Creative Control on Facebook if you like. You can also follow the show on Twitter at VishCreative, or you can follow me directly on Twitter and on Instagram at Vishkana. Also visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to keep this podcast on its feet. $6 or more a month grants you access to exclusive content, including in some cases bonus content from current episodes. In other cases, I dip back into the archive. I have a pretty huge archive of audio recordings, interviews rather, and so sometimes I dig some up and I post them up on the Patreon. So if you want to travel back in time with me to when I really, really didn't know what I was doing, but people tolerated me nonetheless. Anyway, that's some of the stuff. But like I say, I've also been spending some time with people that are currently on the show and getting a little bit of bonus stuff with them. And I share that on the Patreon. Anyway, $6 or more a month grants you access to all that exclusive content. And if you're interested in receiving a Creative Control t-shirt, just message me on Patreon and I will get you one while supplies last. Again, that address, patreon.com/creativecontrol. Thanks again to the fine Alberta record retailer Blackbird Music, which you can learn more about and place orders at via their website, blackbird.ca. Also want to thank Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, for their in-kind support for this show. Thanks, as always, to my friend Jim Guthrie for letting me use some music of his on this show. You can learn more about Jim at his website, jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you very much for listening to this pretty expansive and this episode with Dan went all over the place. Kind of on me on that one. I hope you enjoyed it. We just went all over the place. It's nice to have Dan back. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to this podcast. Ask your friends to do the same. Spread the word about the show. All of that stuff helps. It means a lot. And it does really help. It really does keep the show going. So thanks again for all of those things if you can do them. Otherwise, be well. Stay healthy if you can. I will talk to you very soon. Bye for now.
If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift giving to the next level, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.